Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days, and there are days as well.
Feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
Can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City,
the Shambhala New York podcast.
And this is episode 111 of the podcast. 111, three ones, 111. Hey. I'm Dave, your host. I will never do that again, I promise you. Hey, today on the podcast, Shante Smalls is going to talk to us from a recording of a talk at our weekly Dharma gathering from a few weeks ago. The topic, why meditate? Very elementary question. I don't think we ever addressed the question. Maybe in a roundabout way, of course. But Shante's going to be addressing it head on. Why meditate? But before we get to that, I do want to mention that you should save the weekend of October 28th, 29th, and 30th. That will be our Shambhala training weekend one, our introductory weekend intensive. Called Feel Human Again. And this is a great opportunity to deepen your practice to dive in for the first time. Friday night, Saturday, and half of Sunday is our introductory weekend meditation course called Feel Human Again. And it is being taught by Lodro Rinzler, friend of the podcast, a frequent contributor, best-selling author, Lodro Rinzler. For more information and to register, go to ny.shambhala.org, click Classes and Programs, and scroll to Feel Human Again, Shambhala Training Weekend 1. That's October 28th, 29th, and 30th. And now, Dr. Shante Paradigm Smalls. She is a writer, she is a scholar, she is a professor, and she is a meditator and a meditation teacher and instructor in the Shambhala Buddhist tradition. She is going to be talking to us about her journey, why she meditates, and why one meditates. Dr. Smalls? Paging Dr. Smalls?
So what about this question of why meditate? Maybe I'd love to hear from some people. Do we have a microphone for maybe two or three people if you aren't too shy? You might just want to say, why do you, or why does one, meditate?
I dared my friend and my wife to go after me if I went first. They said, yeah. But no, actually, I'm not from New York City, but it feels like the energy is really intense up here, and people are going very fast. So maybe in a world where the world feels kind of crazy, and the mind feels kind of crazy,
yes,
then relieving yourself of a little bit of crazy is a good thing. Okay. So why meditate would be to help yourself be less crazy.
Okay, great. So working with speediness, that's excellent. Okay, don't force your wife to, she doesn't want to. You know, come on here. Okay, well, thank
all right.
you.
Very interesting experience. This is my second time in Shambhala. We went to DC for the first open house as well, ourselves. And my experience with meditation is usually eyes closed,
sure,
where I can go to faraway realms of happiness and joy and emptiness very easily. And with the experience of mine, with my eyes open, it feels very overwhelming. It felt very overwhelming, almost as if I was taking in the entire, you know, whatever area that was in front of me.
Yes.
And it felt more unsettling than settling.
Hmm.
And the question of why meditate, and maybe why, when these experiences of overwhelm can happen either when we're attempting to meditate or not meditate. So maybe more of a an open-ended question.
Mm-hmm. Okay. My wife made me go. Okay, great. I see there's a lot of spousal coercion tonight. Okay, that's why you meditate.
Yeah. No, I meditate because my mind has just been way too seized up by politics lately, and I just need to calm down my nervous system.
Yes.
And it's helping.
Okay,
so
great.
Thank you.
Great. Okay, so we've got speedy mind. We've got, well, why would we do this when we encounter kind of unsettling or uncomfortable feelings? And then we've got the conditions of the world, so U.S. politics, right? Okay. So thank you. Does that sound, are any of those things relevant to other people here? Okay, yeah, I see some nods. So I'll say, I'm going to talk about four reasons why one might meditate. They're not exhaustive, but I think they're exemplary. But before that, if you don't mind, I'll say a little bit about why I started meditating. So for me, meditation started off as a theoretical and intellectual curiosity. When I was a teenager, when I was 16, I met some Dharma punks. Do people know Dharma punks, that sangha? So Noah Levine, who was, he ended up in prison. In prison, he discovered meditation. He's in a spirit rock tradition. And he's, you know, tattooed, punk rock kind of, and was, I've met him. I've had some conversations with him over the years. And I met these guys, these young guys, like, you know, a little older than I was, who were these, like, punk rock tattooed meditator. And at the time, I have lots of tattoos now, but at the time I had one tattoo. I was just starting my tattoo process. But I was really taken by the kind of different embodiment of a meditator. You know, these guys wore leather jackets and listened to, you know, Pearl Jam was different at the time. It was the 90s. But Nirvana, and they were like, you know, we were going to Lollapalooza. And I just was like, sort of like, wow. So I was really curious about why they did it and what they did. And so I started reading with different traditions and sometimes practicing. But I was more kind of impressed with myself, the idea of talking about meditation than actually sitting. And I, for a long time, for many years, I would meditate kind of in an emergency. So it was like, I'm feeling overwhelmed, I'm going to meditate. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's actually a quite reasonable reaction to the overwhelmingness of the human experience. So that was my experience for, let's say that was my first phase of my meditation experience. And maybe that was for, I don't know, eight, nine, through college. I moved to New York, or back to New York after college, and in the late 90s, early 2000s, and a friend of mine started going to a meditation center, actually not far from here in Union Square, and I was sort of drawn to that because I had been doing things on my own, aka not doing them. And so I started going to this sangha, this meditation community, meditation center, and I really discovered encountered the power of meditating in a group with other people at the same time, having some friends. There were like 5 or 10 of my friends. We were all, for maybe a year or so, practicing the same way and keeping each other practicing and starting to read books. And so that was super helpful. And then one day that was like the second phase where I found the sangha, right? So I kind of had the aspiration and the desire to meditate. And then I found a group of people who were also meditating. And one day I was at a bookstore and someone had kept mentioning this person, Pema Chodron, right? And I kept hearing this name, and I got a book of hers, and then I picked this other book that was really cute and little that was called Shambhala, Sacred Path of the Warrior, written by this gentleman, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. And the reason I picked that book, one, it was little, two, the title was awesome, Shambhala, Sacred Path of the Warrior, And I was practicing martial arts at the time, and so I was really interested in bringing my physical martial arts practice together with spiritual practice. I was trying lots of different things. It wasn't cohesive. And what I didn't know was that this gentleman was and is, I mean, he's deceased, but was and is Pema Chodron's teacher. So it was total kismet. It was auspicious. I picked these two people, and I was reading what they were saying in very different language, and I was so moved. And the sangha I was attending at the time was amazing, and I was really into it. But I also found myself drawn to this message that these two teachers were in their books that were their words were bringing me to tears. People I'd never had met, but I was meeting their minds through their written work. And so, like any good, sensible person who's trying to find a meditation path, I decided what would be great is if I figured out a way to go to Nova Scotia, where Pema Chodron lived, and practice with her, because there probably wasn't anywhere to practice here in New York. And so I was on the website of Gampo Abbey, which is the one, well, technically two, but the one monastic center in the Shambhala tradition, because we're a lay tradition. And I was like, Shambhala, wait a minute. And then I realized the book was named Shambhala Public. Anyway, so I put it together. And so I searched Shambhala in New York, and I discovered there was a center here in Chelsea. So I started coming to the Tuesday night Dharma gatherings, and I would come right at 7 or a little after. I would sit. I would really enjoy it. That's not the whole story, but I would listen to the teacher, and it would be great, and then I would run out because I was scared, and I didn't want to stay for the cheese and crackers. And then little by little, I would come a little early, and people would say hi, and I was like, what do you want? And I would sit, I would listen to the teacher, and once I even asked a question, and then I began to stay. And I found it here, I'm not sure what your experience was, but I found it a very light touch. There was no one was trying to push anything on me, no one was trying to sell me anything. People were pretty welcoming. And I just did a lot of watching, and I knew that when I came here, I genuinely felt different. Not necessarily better all the time, but I felt different, and I felt something was happening here. And I was curious about that. And I became more and more curious about my own mind and my own experience and why people would, on a Tuesday night, pay money or time and come and sit on the cushions and sit in a room and with a bunch of weird stuff on the walls and listen to someone talk. Usually the talks were often about death, as we're Buddhists, but they were somehow uplifting. So that was my journey, and eventually I just became more and more just seduced and in love with this process of not only a sitting practice on my own, but being a part of a community of meditators. And so one day I was sitting here, and the teacher, one of our senior teachers, Acharya Eric Spiegel, said, you know, if any of you are interested in going deeper into your practice, we have a level one. And I didn't know what that meant, but it was a weekend, an introductory weekend of sitting. So we'd come on Friday night and have a talk and sit all day Saturday, all day Sunday. And I thought, oh, that sounds amazing. I can totally do that. And I had a real encounter with my mind, which was shocking. I found out that I was hated the person in front of me, who I never met, because her ponytail was in my face for the entire weekend. I want to meet, I don't know who she is, you know what I mean? But I was like, I hate her. She's so irritating. Why is she sitting in front of me? And I was like, who is this person? Me. And I experienced such a torrent of fears and projection of the future and conversations in the past and thoughts about food I never knew I was so interested in food, and thoughts about my body, thoughts about sex, thoughts about apocalypse, thoughts about movies. I was going to write a review of that movie that I saw. I mean, like, it just, you know, it was endless. And there I was meeting my mind. That was my mind. That was the quality of my mind. Busy, inquisitive, judgmental, fearful, but also curious and open, and some spark of desire to learn what it meant to be present. I had heard the word mindfulness, I'd heard the word awareness, I'd heard them used in relation to one another, and I heard them used in relationship to sitting down and paying attention, but I didn't really know what that meant in terms of my own experience. And so slowly I began to cultivate a mind of an aware and a mindful mind by sitting, paying attention to my breath, which is fortunately for me always present. And when my mind began to do the thing that mind does, which is to have thoughts, to not freak out, to not get seduced, but to come back to the breath. And then I began to have other questions. Why am I doing this? What's the point? How's this going to help me? How's this going to benefit me? Right, of course, you know, I'm very, was brought up in this culture in the U.S., and so I'm very attuned to thinking about me. I'm very good at thinking about me and also how I can get what I want. So in a way, I had been my whole life meditating. I had actually been meditating my whole life, but the object of my meditation has always been me and mine and I. And maybe you, but you in relationship to me. And what you can give me, or what I can get from you, or what, I mean, not to say I'm a bad person, I guess, but it sounds like I'm, you know, pretty Game of Thronesy, but it's, you know, that's the kind of condition I was, you know, I was brought up in, that kind of world, to, you know, not trust, and to be wary, and to remember slights. And here they were saying things like, be gentle, and, you know, relax. How can I relax? I'm trying to not think, you know, and cultivate mindfulness and awareness. And, you know, I was like, okay. So one of the things that really got me or struck me is that I began to notice that when I got up off the cushion, it wasn't that I was necessarily transformed or a better person or anything like that. But there was just a little bit of space between me and my thoughts. There's a little bit of a pause between me and my impulse to curse someone out in the street, okay? Let's be honest. That's, you know, that's one of my favorite things to do, is to curse someone out on the street. I'm a New Yorker, and these are things that sometimes New Yorkers do. But there was a little bit of a pause between that impulse to not be taken advantage of because someone cut me off, right? Or a taxi driver didn't stop, or a biker, you know, nearly ran me over, or, you know, the bane of all New Yorkers' existence, a group of tourists were in a line, you know, like a can-can line across the, you know, sidewalk, and I couldn't get around to my important corner to cross the street to go to the next corner, you know? So I began to notice that there was a little bit of maybe I didn't have to do those things. I could still have those thoughts, maybe, but maybe I didn't have to be that person on the street. And that caught my attention because I felt like those actions, or that kind of posturing, was sort of positive. It got me what I wanted in the world. People were like, oh, you're so funny, or oh, that was awesome, or, you know, whatever. I felt a sense of inflation or safety or ego solidity. But when I didn't do those things, I didn't die. Nothing bad happened if I didn't let my thoughts be known to a random stranger on the street. I continued on with my day. That person continued on with their day. The world continued to turn. So it struck me that maybe I could, like, you know, pay a little bit more attention to that. And, you know, my journey began and it continues. So, it's four things on why meditate. Sort of the, maybe the ultimate reason and maybe the least sexy reason is to prepare for death and the process of dying, which is going to happen to every one of us and everyone we know and love. And perhaps for most of us and many of us, depending on where we were raised in the world or how we were raised, if we were raised in the West, death is actually something to avoid. You know, we think about prolonging life and, you know, death is hopefully something very, very far away. And that, yeah, we all hope that, and that's not really a problem, except for if death is certain and the time of death is uncertain, how am I going to deal with this part of life, this transition? How am I going to deal when those transitions happen with people and things I love? And it's not even necessarily physical death, but the end of relationships, the end of jobs, moving. Don't laugh at me, but the end of a TV show you really love, you know? It took me a long time to get over Buffy when it ended. Serious, you know? I don't know what I'm already projecting about. What am I going to do when Game of Thrones ends? I mean, seriously, like, it's got two more seasons and it's a television show, but these are some thoughts that I have. So, you know, how do I deal with endings without leaving my claw marks on everything, right? Or disappearing out of the process of any kind of relationship so I don't have to deal with the pain of ending, right? So that's sort of the ultimate reason, which I won't spend a whole lot of time talking about, but I just wanted to mention that because that is one reason to meditate. And, you know, I've had that experience of people I love, you know, die. My mother died, for instance, and how dealing with the process of watching her die and then dealing with her death and the after effects of that, how do I comprehend such an incomprehensible reality? So the second one, maybe, which leads many of us or some of us to be curious about meditation or to be curious about mindfulness, is we want to feel better. So we've maybe seen something on TV or read something in our newspaper that talked that the science of mindfulness, you know, and it helps you, like, your memory is better and maybe you'll live longer and your blood pressure and, you know, get a dog or a cat and, like, they're mindful and all kinds of things, right? So we want to feel better. We want a solution to this human condition. And maybe what we feel is like a lonely or painful set of experiences sometimes. So we've heard that meditating can help us. And maybe we might achieve this thing called enlightenment, and that sounds really awesome. Because if we're enlightened, then maybe we can just float above all the world's problems and not be affected by anything. But then we find out that that's not what enlightenment is. But maybe it's we want to feel better. And we might, and we will feel better, and we will feel worse, and we will feel the same. We'll feel. But this is a really important thing because it gets a lot of us to the cushion. And it gets a lot of us to stay on the cushion. And so I wanted to mention that. So the third thing is sort of the inverse of the second, which is that we have the experience of a sense of disillusionment. We're dissatisfied with our life, or maybe with the quality of our mind. Maybe we even know that. We're like Neo from The Matrix. Do people know that reference? People seen that movie? You remember that? I mean, it was a long time ago, 1999, when the first one came out. But basically, this character had this sense that something wasn't right with the world, with his world. And he had a dual life. By day, worked for a well-respected multinational corporation. Yes, I know this story quite well. By night, a hacker. And that brought him into contact with awake people, let's say. People who were operating on a different frequency from the kind of conveyor belt-like society he was in that was so dissatisfactory. And so we may, like Neo, have a sense that, you know, well, I remember being younger, I remember being little, we might say to ourselves, and I remember being able to be immersed in a game or an activity or a friendship or anything for hours. Do you remember that? Does anyone have that sensation when you were young where you could play in the dirt, literally, for hours? Dirt! I mean, like, dirt, you know what I mean? For hours. Maybe you had an imaginary friend, or maybe you had a real friend, it didn't matter. But there was a sense of, for some of us, perhaps, who had this experience, not all of us maybe had this experience, a sense of play and imagination and also presentness. It didn't take a lot for us to be entertained. And so we have this ability, we have this quality to be present in the circumstances of our lives, no matter how great or small. We actually have that innate ability as human beings. It's one of the gifts of being human. So that's not something we have to import. It's not even something we have to discover, but it may be something we have to uncover. It may be that it's buried underneath a lot of habit. The technology today is quite speedy. There's always been technology, right? Since we first discovered fire or how to make a wheel. So that technology has always been seductive, it seems, what history tells us. And we're in a moment now, and we have been in a moment where the last 50 or 100 years, we've made, as they say, more discoveries, more scientific discoveries and technological advances than maybe have been made in thousands of years, in a long, long time. And those things are, nothing wrong with them, and they're great. And we can also be completely seduced away from our sort of natural inclination or ability to be comfortable with doing absolutely nothing, with just relaxing into the sensation of being here on planet Earth and being experiencing the preciousness of being a human being. So that's the sort of disillusionment or the dissatisfaction. But finally, we might say one of the most powerful and helpful reasons to meditate is that we can become friends with this thing we call a mind. We can form an allyship with our minds. We can be comfortable with ourselves and not ruled by our thoughts, whether they're our own thoughts or whether they're thoughts that come from elsewhere, that penetrate our mind and our heart, that shake us to our core. So sometimes when we're talking about in beginning meditation, we talk about building stability, clarity, and strength. The stability of the mind to not be thrown, how to say this without it sounding extreme. So it's not that we don't have emotions or thoughts. and that we don't have reactions based on those emotions or thoughts. Absolutely, that's part of being a human being. We should have emotions, we should have thoughts. But sometimes a thought and an emotion can convince us that it is a reality. And maybe we can spend a lifetime pursuing that thought or emotion that's actually not a reality. And instead, we can develop a stability of our minds where we can take in information or things can occur to us, but we're not thrown off balance always or for long. And clarity, I think, you know, it's pretty self-explanatory, but we become more adept at seeing maybe what's helpful and what's not helpful. So it's not about moralism, right, or good and bad. So maybe some of us have grown up with good and bad, you know, that's a good thought, that's a bad thought, that's a good action, that's a bad action. But it's more like, will this help myself and other people, or will this harm myself and other people? And sometimes we still choose the harm, right? I know I do sometimes. But we also begin to develop this other, we begin to cultivate this other, let's say, path or groove or road. So we have maybe this well-trod road, it's paved, and that's of, you know, sort of doing the thing that's always about sort of self-gratification. But the clarity helps us to kind of build this other road about, well, maybe I can maybe I can hold off on that and just see whether that's actually going to help me with my anxiety about my deadline. Right? Whether that's actually going to help build intimacy in my relationship with my ex, you know. Not ex, but, you know. Well, maybe, but situation X, person X, child, friend, lover, parent, neighbor. I have a neighbor who's the bane of my existence. And, you know, it's really not based on anything real. When I moved into this apartment a little over 2 years ago, he's a lovely gentleman. He's a character, you know. He's a great, great character. And we had a, you know, we had an interaction. And he reminded me of that interaction every time I saw him for the next 6 months. And so I began to develop a story about him. This guy's a dick, you know, like, who does he think he is? I'll show him. I mean, I don't know, just all kinds of, like, thoughts aimed at him that were really kind of poisoning my mind, taking up a lot of space in my mind. And when I would see him, I would have all this story about him, but I didn't know his name for those 6 months. I had to find out his name from someone else in the building. And I was like, oh, okay, right. This is the problem, because I don't know this person. And yet I've decided that, you know, they're off my radar in terms of someone worthy of my compassion or thoughtfulness or anything. And so, you know, I really had to work with relaxing that story and releasing that. And it took a while. I saw him on my way here, and I just smiled and giggled, which was a really different reaction than I had like a year and a half ago. And then the strength part is kind of about having both the confidence and the fortitude and the aspiration and the discipline, really, which means the gentle consistency. Let's think about discipline like that. Discipline as gentle consistency rather than as something hard or militaristic or punitive. Strength is really about having the gentle consistency and the love to show up for yourself and say, you know, I want to get to know myself better. I want to feel the quality of my breath. I want to experience the quality of my mind and my heart, which are really one and the same. You know, the mind is not in the head, it's here. It's in the heart center, according to the Tibetan tradition. And I wanna not run away from that, but I wanna experience that. What am I like in the world when I'm present? I don't have to become a monastic. I don't have to put on any airs. I don't have to stop swearing, which obviously I haven't. I don't have to, you know, I don't have to do anything except for maybe be curious about who am I really? Not what's my job, not, you know, my title, not what I've done or what person I might be in a relationship or where I live or my economic situation. But who am I really? I'm an awakened being who doesn't know that yet. Right? I'm someone able to fully wake up, but I don't trust that yet. I trust maybe the gym. Maybe. I trust maybe yoga class. I trust tacos, you know. Maybe I trust alcohol and drugs. I trust sex, right? I trust entertainment. But I don't trust myself. I don't trust my own awakened nature. I feel I'm deficient and I need to water myself with something else in order to fully blossom. But the practice of meditation says, no, no, no. I just have to sit down or walk or lay down. And if I'm new to this, I find an object of meditation. My breath. It's the easiest thing, but there are other things. And I am mindful of my breath. And while I'm being mindful of my breath, I realize I have this thing called awareness that is watching the situation. And I have things go on in my body while I'm doing that. I have things going on in my mind, memories, flashes, sensations. And then I do it again. And then I do it again, and I do it some more. Or maybe I don't do it for a while because I feel so uncomfortable. So I just want to read a little quote, and then I'd like to have some questions, and I'm not sure if there'll be answers, but I would love to have questions. So this gentleman here is named Sakyong, is his title. Sakyong, which means basically earth kind of king. Mipam Rinpoche, Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche, and he is the son of Chogyam Trimpa Rinpoche. Rinpoche is not their last name, it's an honorific, basically meaning like an awakened, a realized teacher. And he is our current head of this lineage of Shambhala. And he's a pretty cool guy. And he's written some books. And I think Turning the Mind to an Ally was his first or second book, at any rate. It's a great book. And I've been rereading it because I'm teaching a class called Meditation in Everyday Life here, and this is one of the texts. And I have forgotten how many just gems and the simplicity and the kind of love that went into this book. I can talk more about him later if you want, but anyway. And he's my teacher. So he says, It seems we all agree that training the body through exercise, diet, and relaxation is a good idea. But why don't we think about training our mind? Working with our mind and emotional states can help us in any activity in which we engage, whether it's sports, or business, or study, or a religious path. If we want to undo our own bewilderment and suffering, and be of benefit to others and the planet, we're going to have to be responsible for learning what our own mind is and how it works, no matter what beliefs we hold. Once we see how our mind works, we see how our life works too. That changes us. So with that, maybe I'll open it up for some questions.
The sense of overwhelm. So having overwhelming experiences both in meditation and out of meditation.
So have you felt overwhelmed when you're meditating? Just now?
Because it's a very, very new experience for me to meditate with my eyes open. So it's like taking in very, very deeply. I was paying attention to my breath, and that was like, oh my God, what do I do with all that?
So what's happening?
Still breathing, but still just the a sense of a feeling of overwhelm. I trust that it is part of the experience, and I'm going to continue on. I'm just too little for me to tell.
Sure.
But I thought it would be helpful as a question.
Yes, it is. First of all, let me say, if there are any people who normally or usually meditate with their eyes closed, that's a perfectly well-worn, beautiful, and amazing technique. Different traditions have different techniques. So the logic behind why we, in the Tibetan tradition, which Shambhala is a part of, meditate with our eyes open, is that we're working with all of our sense perceptions on the cushion, all of the ones that are available to us. So some people may not have eyesight or hearing or other senses, but we work with whatever senses we have in order to work with those senses off the cushion. There are all kinds of things that we can do both with our eyes open, with our eyes closed, to space out. It's not like in one you space out and one you don't. I've spaced out a lot with my eyes open. I've fallen asleep with my eyes open on the cushion. But in general, we're trying to work with not receding sort of into the mind, but rather, sort of, I said it in a glib way, but working with the irritation of the situation not being totally perfect. So when you sit in a group in particular, but this happens with ourselves too, when you sit in a group in particular, one of the things that you start to notice is that you find objects for your irritation. So someone moves, someone coughs too much, someone has a ponytail and they're in front of you. Or other ambient noises, like in the winter, the radiators make radiator sounds, and I'm trying to meditate, but the inverse of that is that the wisdom in that is that we actually are aware of a lot more things that we usually block out. So it's really about, in certain traditions, depending on their lineage, their emphasis is put on different areas. So in a monastic situation, the emphasis might be on releasing ties from sense perceptions in order to fully awaken. But since we're lay people, we work with our sense perceptions. We work with the busyness with work and family and strangers and community and environment. And so that's going to bring up discomfort. But that's not a reason to stop. You can get curious about that. And of course, if you're really, 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 really overwhelmed, come out of meditation. This is not an endurance test. This is not about hurting yourself or scaring yourself. So if it's too much, just sit back, relax, and enjoy the quietness. And then maybe at another time you can try it again. Is that helpful? Okay.
I'm a relatively new to meditation. I've tried it over the years, but I'm doing it more consistently in the last, 6 or 7 months. I think for me the hardest part, and you can maybe speak to it as someone more experienced, is how to hold this particular pose, I guess. Mm. And when I feel like the pose for me, and I've been told in with the people that I practice that it's something that you kind of get over after a while. It's hard, like I feel like all my concentration goes to holding the pose, and I feel like I'm kind of spacing out because of that.
Yes.
As opposed to how relaxed should you be and how much should you focus on your pose and your experience, I guess.
So what about the posture is challenging for you? Are you finding yourself falling out of it? Are you in pain? Should you bring it back there? Yeah, we're recording it, so that's why.
Yeah. Oh, got it. I find that, like, my feet fall asleep.
Yes. Okay.
My legs fall asleep. My hips hurt. My back hurts.
Okay. Yeah. Yes. This is a pretty typical experience for new meditators who have not grown up sitting in the Vajra position, which many of us have not grown up sitting in that position. So our hip flexors, our ITB, this whole range of our body is tight. So we also have body structure. We all have different structures of our hips, of our, it's all different. So my suggestion is to always be comfortable. So that may include using two gomdens instead of one, stacking them on top of each other, so that your hips are always above your knees, and we might have to have a significant difference between hips and knees for a while. There's nothing wrong with that. I know for me, when I first started so much, I began to realize I had so much ego about my posture, and as if other people were paying attention to my posture, and if they were, who cares? But because I was doing a lot of yoga at the time, I had a lot of ideas about being a meditator, and so it was hard for me to actually meditate because my ideas about meditation got in the way. So sometimes I would make myself sit in a chair so that I just could let all of that go and I could just be comfortable. But you can work with the height of your, and also the each gomden has a different firmness, so you can work with height and firmness and see how that goes. But certainly you're not supposed to be in pain, in agony. So you might want to meditate in a chair, which is the same meditation, but you're not leaning back. You're sitting up, feet are on the ground, hands are here. I mean, you'll find yourself in a slump too, but you're not going to be in the same amount of pain. And then you can just work on that or not. But it's the physical pain that comes up. And certainly if you meditate for longer periods, you experience thinking in the form of physical discomfort. So you might want to sit for shorter periods of time, 5 or 10 minutes. Stretch beforehand if you can. Stretch after.
I think you said something really profound, and it just hit me, and I just wanted to thank you for that. You said you can really be friends with your mind, and I feel like, we spend so much of our time, trying to shut out those inner voices that may not be helping us.
Yeah.
And I just started meditation, and one of the wonderful things that my teacher said was, you know, if you have a thought, you can just have that thought. And she said, you know, put it on a cloud and watch the cloud go away. And it's not that you're not going to think about that problem. You're just setting it aside. And I think there's something so exciting about being able to just notice when you're hearing your mind say something. And I just thought if you might elaborate a little more on being in a positive relationship with your own mind, that would be really helpful. Thank you.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah, so some of it has to do with I think our general cultural idea about what meditation is. So you'll hear people say, oh, be Zen about it or whatever, which usually interprets as a kind of a shorthand for either having no reaction or no feelings or no thoughts about a situation, or is some kind of weird orientalist, you know, mysterious invocation of a Zen master. So if we think about our mind as, if we think about you want to change the contents of your apartment, say, or you want to do some redecorating on a budget, you have to know what's in there. You have to know what's useful, what's sort of helpful and what's not, what works in the space you have and what maybe doesn't anymore. And you know, and to acknowledge that things change. So maybe these some of these thoughts we have that we might call default thoughts served us at a different point in our lives. Maybe when we were younger, children. Maybe some of us are hyper aware of our environment, and maybe that was really important. Maybe we grew up in an environment where we needed to be hyper aware, and maybe that's not so useful now. But it's so deeply habituated in us that it feels like it's real. So we kind of have to take stock. What do I actually think? What happens when I'm not distracted? And to get familiar with what actually comes up in my mind, rather than, okay, the ideal thoughts or the ideal way would be X, but what's actually, what are the contents, or what's the sort of feeling? But we have to be curious first. We can't just say, I'm going to swap this mind out for another mind. That's impossible. So we work with analogies and approximations and, of course, practice. But we have so much judgment about what we're doing. Like, I'm bad, you know, I had a thought. Which is good. We're glad the brain is active, right? I did it wrong. So much judgment. Or I did it right. Yay, I'm perfect. Freeze. Just going to put that on repeat. And it's a living practice. It's a living practice. I will say that as someone who's been in this tradition for 10 years, that I have gotten so much more relaxed about my meditation, even as I meditate more and more for longer and longer, and more and more deeply, I'm like so much more chill. So today, I was in a 3-week retreat with this gentleman. Well, he only was there for a week, but anyway, with us. But recently, I just got back a couple weeks ago, and so we were given some new practices. And as I was working with that earlier today, I realized that I was having the exact same experience that I had when I was first introduced to shamatha, which was to say doubt that I would get it. But this time, what's different now is I just recognize that doubt is part of my experience, and so I don't try to get rid of the doubt. I just said to myself, oh, at some point, I'll have a different experience. And I just went back, and I was kind of fumbling and struggling and not very good at it. And whereas in the beginning of the process, it was like I felt like there was some kind of mindfulness police watching me to say whether I could stay or not. That is to say, my mind was looking for a way to not meditate. So the Sakyong says in this book that if our mind is like a wild horse, we treat it like a wild horse and we give it all the space it needs. So rather than trying to put that wild horse, put a saddle on it, it's a weird analogy, but he's an equestrian anyway, put a saddle on it, put it in a barn, lock it up until it behaves, say, run free, baby, and wear yourself out. And eventually, what happens, or at least in my experience, is that it becomes easier to be mindful and to be present than it is to space out. Spacing out actually becomes really tiresome. I can't generate enough spaciness to take up the time. So actually being mindful makes the time go by. But the real thing is developing this quality of, cultivating this quality of like gentleness towards yourself, or friendliness towards yourself. Like, I'm doing the best I can for right now, and it's going to change. I want to thank you all for your practice and for your questions and for your presence. Please enjoy the snacks.
Yes, snacks. The ultimate way to the meditator's heart. Thank you, Dr. Shante Smalls, for a great talk. Why meditate? Sometimes you just got to think, why? Why do we want to do this? Why would one do this? What is this about? For more information about the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York, visit our website, ny.shambhala.org. You'll see our list of classes and weekend retreats. You can come visit our weekly Dharma gathering every Tuesday night in person at 7 o'clock. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look us up. Thanks for listening. I'm going to go eat a low-carb snack. Later.